Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And now I'd like to turn the meeting over to Ms. Sandy Walsh. Ma'am, you may begin.
Hi, this is Sandy Walsh with the FDA's Office of Public Affairs. I'm joined today from some representatives from our Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. Dr. Russell Capps will be our leader today, and also he's with the Division of Neurology Products in Cedar, as well as Dr. Jane Litka and Dr. Jill Lindstrom from the Division of Dermatology and Dental Products. What we're going to do today is have Dr. Capps give you a brief overview of the announcement we made today regarding Botox, and then we will take questions from credentialed media only. And the operator can go through that process with you on how to ask a question as soon as we get to that portion. But we'll go ahead and do a quick overview from Dr. Russell Capps.
Hi, thanks, Sandy. Yeah, I'll be very brief. I just want to say that the agency announced today that we've become aware of a number of reports of serious adverse reactions related to the use of botulinum toxin products. And these are reactions that suggest that that involve parts of the body and adverse reactions distant, physically distant from the site of injection. It's well known that these products can cause adverse events locally, close to where the products are injected, and also rarely that they have been able to cause some of these more distant side effects, including problems with breathing, in certain cases. The current labeling for these products talks about the rare potential for these distant adverse effects, including problems swallowing and problems breathing, in patients with what the labeling terms are, underlying neuromuscular disorders. We now believe we have reports of these distant side effects, some of which have been severe, and which, as the early communications suggest, include hospitalization and death in patients without what we would call underlying neuromuscular disorders. Most of the cases that we are concerned about and that have been serious have been cases in pediatric patients who've been treated for spasticity, usually in the lower limbs, which is an off-label use. That is to say, none of the products are approved for use in children with any condition below the age of 12, and they're not approved to treat spasticity secondary to cerebral palsy. That doesn't mean that such off-label use is inappropriate. It's apparently done widely and successfully in many cases, and that's appropriate as judged by the physician community. But they are not approved for those indications. We think that the current labeling is not as clear on this point about these distant effects in children, first of all, and in patients without underlying neuromuscular disorders. And so we are continuing to evaluate these reports. We have asked the manufacturers of these drugs to submit to us their comprehensive review of their databases. We're looking at those now, and we're in the middle of trying to get a better handle on the details. I know that a number of you are interested in specific numbers of cases of death or hospitalization. Because this is still quite early in our assessment, and the numbers of cases are fluid in the sense of do we think that this case or that case is specifically related to these distant effects is still ongoing. So we're reluctant to describe specific numbers, but as we say in the early communication, there have been hospitalizations, there has been at least one death attributed to these distant effects. So I think as an overview, I'll stop there, and if you have any questions that I can answer, I'm happy to take them.
Okay, operator, we're going to go ahead and open our question and answer period for credentialed media only.
Thank you, ma'am. If anyone from the media would like to ask a question, please press star one. You will be prompted to record your first and last name for pronunciation purposes. To withdraw your request, you may press star two. Once again, if you have a question and you're from the media, press star 1 now. One moment for our first question. Our first question comes from Peggy Peck with MedPage Today.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my question. Dr. Katz, I know you said that you don't have exact numbers, but I'm wondering if you can give some sort of an estimate. Are we talking in the hundreds, in less than 100, in the thousands? In terms of adverse events. And the other thing is I'm wondering if you could give some sense of use, practical use of Botox off-label and off-label indications, because I see often studies, as a matter of fact, in off-label indications. So my sense is that this drug is widely used for a number of indications that are not on the label.
As far as the sort of a ballpark number, it's in terms of the specific adverse events that we're talking about, which are these what we're attributing to distance spread of the toxin. We're not talking about hundreds, not by our numbers. It's a relative handful. But again, different people have different numbers, and we're relying on the numbers that we've generated from our adverse event reporting system. The company's numbers are probably different. Other folks might have different numbers. But as far as these serious adverse events that we're talking about specifically today, it's a relatively small number. Of course, we don't really know the exact number because when you rely on post-marketing reports, we assume that there's some under-reporting of some degree or another. So we don't really know the exact number. All we know is what we have in the system.
Would it be accurate to say less than 100?
Of these specific events, yeah, in our view. As far as the use, I can't speak to that. We have some information about usage, which is actually not releasable. So certainly it is used off-label, and it's certainly used for this indication in pediatric patients off-label. And as I say, that's perfectly appropriate if the physician believes it's appropriate. The agency doesn't typically have much to do with off-label use.
Okay, next question, please.
Our next question comes from Lynn Peterson, Trends in Medicine.
I actually have two questions. Is this a response to the public citizen petition, number one? And number two, what does this mean for the cosmetic use? If you're using it in the face, is that maybe safer than if you use it in the neck?
Yeah, okay. As far as this effort being a response to the citizen petitions, it is not. We had been working on this for a while prior to the submission of that citizen petition. So this really in no way is in response to the citizen petition, although, of course, we're reviewing that and trying to see how this all fits together. As far as safety and cosmetic use, again, most of the cases that we're particularly concerned about have occurred in children who have been given injections in the legs, typically for spasticity, for increased tone of the muscles, and that in those cases we believe that the toxin is spread and involves the muscles of breathing, the respiratory muscles. There are some reports, a very few number of reports of these sort of distant effects with cosmetic use, but extremely rare, and it's not even really clear whether or not those events could be attributed to the treatment. It's not to say that we don't believe it can't happen. Those doses usually using the cosmetic, the doses are usually much smaller, and that's not a big part of what we're seeing here.
Okay, next question, please.
Our next question comes from Lisa Richwine with Reuters.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I'm just following up on that last point on Botox cosmetic. Or do you know, were any of the deaths in patients getting this for cosmetic use?
No.
Okay.
Not that we know. But again, as I say, numbers vary. depending on who's supplying the numbers.
Right, right. And I know you've already addressed this issue of the numbers, but if I could bring it up again and mention that Public Citizen had said 16 deaths, I mean, is that in the ballpark of what you've seen?
Again, let me...
Without your number, then we're forced to use their number, so...
Yeah, I don't want to speak specifically to the numbers. The only thing I would say about deaths or the reports of any specific adverse event that that we obtain from post-marketing setting, there are more or less deaths depending upon what you're talking about. It's, what we're particularly interested in is whether or not there have been deaths or serious reactions related to the distance spread, which looks a lot like, naturally, if I can use that word, occurring botulism.
Okay.
There may be deaths reported, but they
may
be due to completely different reasons.
Right, yeah.
And these populations, particularly the pediatric population with cerebral palsy, can be quite sick. And so bad things happen to those kids naturally, unfortunately. So it's a question of numbers of deaths related to this event or numbers that we think are related to this event or numbers of deaths that are in our system just in total.
Yeah,
so
I think we'd all like to know, you know, the ones you think might be related.
Yeah, very, very few, very few. But again, we're still in the middle of looking at this in detail.
Okay, so you said, I think, a relative handful of deaths?
A relative handful of any of these serious reactions, including hospitalization and death.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next question, please.
Next question comes from Jennifer Smith from FDA Week.
Hi, doctor. I just want to confirm again when you mentioned about the inadequate labeling right now that if you can go over that labeling component again, as well as now Public Citizen has asked again if therefore for a black box on these Myoplex and for these Botox products. So I'm wondering if that's a consideration FDA has if the labeling is not sufficient.
Yeah, the current labeling has in the warning section a statement about a rare occurrence of these distant or systemic effects in patients with underlying neuromuscular disorder. And, and they describe what those disorders are, at least examples of those disorders. Most people in the field would not consider spasticity due to cerebral palsy as, strictly speaking, a neuromuscular disorder.
Okay.
And it's not one of the examples that are given in current labeling. So now, again, we have cases which we think are attributable to the treatment in pediatric patients in particular with cerebral palsy and spasticity.
Okay.
So we don't think that's a neuromuscular disorder. That term is commonly understood by physicians. So in that sense, the current labeling doesn't really describe cases of the sort that we now believe we have. So that's why we're looking, obviously, at potentially changing labeling.
Right.
As far as what the new labeling will be, whether there will be a box warning, it's too early to tell. We certainly consider every option. It's certainly also not the case, generally speaking, that all significant adverse events end up in a box warning. There are many considerations that go into where in labeling we put something and how we say it in labeling. So it's a possibility. Sure, it's certainly something to be considered, but it's too premature to say anything definitive about that.
Okay, thank you.
Next question, please.
Lauren Neergard from the Associated Press. Your line's open.
Hi, Dr. Katz. I'm wondering, I guess, what has changed to make this become an issue now? Because it's something that the agency has been aware of for quite some time. I have in front of me a 2005 report authored by FDA people published in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology that talked about 28 deaths, many of them this type, including adults. And today's statement makes it sound like it's a handful of kids that is a brand new thing. So can you go? Go into a little more for me exactly what's changed and talk with me a little bit, too, about those previous descriptions of the adult deaths if they were, you know, maybe ruled out or something.
Well, again, as I say, there's trying to assess causality or mechanism of death from post-marketing reports can be tricky. I think what's new is that we think that in people who do not have these underlying neuromuscular conditions or diseases, we believe we now have documented cases of what presumably is distant spread, was certainly systemic adverse events, and now in particular in pediatric patients. So I think that's what's new, and that's why we're announcing it. As I say, the labeling currently says this can happen rarely in patients with underlying neuromuscular disease. We think we now, anyway, have evidence that it can happen in a broader population. Still, again, by our numbers, I think quite rare, but nonetheless.
Can you talk about dosing?
Excuse me?
Can you talk about dosing? I mean, is the dosing?
The only thing I can say about dosing is what's in the early communication, and that's and it's been seen at a wide range of doses. We've seen some of these significant adverse events at doses that people presumably believe are the appropriate doses for this condition, and cases at doses which are considered to be higher. Now, again, I have to say that none of these products are approved for this use. I'm talking specifically about the spasticity and cerebral palsy in pediatric patients. So none of them are approved for that use. So we of course, cannot endorse any particular dosing regimen for this. No dosing regimen, to the best of our knowledge, has been shown to be safe and effective. Again, that does not mean that it's inappropriate to use it off-label in this way. But and there are guidelines, I gather, for dosing this population off-label. And as I say, some of these cases presumably occurred with doses that conform to those guidelines, and some were at higher doses.
Okay. Next question, please.
Alicia Ault with Skin and Allergy News.
Yes, thank you for taking my questions. Most of my questions have actually been answered, but just on that last point about the dosing and whether this is, it looks like the botulism cases were not just in pediatric, not just kids, but also in adults. So I'm wondering what conditions did those adults have? What were they receiving the injections for? Is it a variety of illnesses or?
Well, I think some were on label. Some were sort of just general muscle spasm. It's, of course, the information from these reports is often incomplete. So it's difficult to tell in many cases exactly what they were getting it for.
So you don't have any kind of clue as to this is only affecting people with spasticity, or you just have no idea?
No, but I think mostly, and again, it depends what you mean by spasticity, but I think mostly the drugs are used in people who have spasm of muscles or spasticity, which are actually two different things, but they both result in what we would say is increased tone of a muscle that someone wants to relax, regardless of why that tone is increased. So it's sort of abnormal contraction of the muscle. So mostly they're used for those sorts of things in various parts of the body.
But it sounds like you can't rule out that any of these were in cases where the Botox might have been used for cosmetic purposes.
I think we think as far as these distant effects, what we call systemic effects, I think we think that we might have a case or two, but that and even those are difficult to attribute to the drug. So there's very few, as far as we know from our database at the moment, again, given a preliminary look at this, that are attributed to cosmetic use. But we don't rule out the possibility that that it might happen with that use, although we think the real message today is particularly in pediatric patients with spasticity, which is really what we think is new, at least with regard to labeling. So is it possible with cosmetic use? Possibly, but is that very unusual.
All right, thank you.
Next question, please.
Jennifer King from Associated Press, your line's open.
My question's been answered. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Next question, please.
Megan Tuohy with the Chicago Tribune.
Yes. Thanks for taking my question. I was wondering what we know about whether or not the injections have caused severe, illness or death for people, anybody who's gotten injected, had the Botox injected in their vocal cords for spasmodic dysphonia?
Yeah. If by our numbers, no, we don't have any reports of that.
Okay. Within this particular data set or period?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning.
Within this specific data set or period?
The post-marketing data reported to the FDA is the data set that we looked at here.
Okay.
In addition to the literature, but that's where most of this information comes from.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Great. Next question, please.
CNN. Amy Burkholder with CNN. Your line's open.
Yes, hello, thank you. We actually have two questions. And my first one is, you make it clear that this appears to be an issue with dosing and not bad Botox. Can you tell us how you know that it's not the Botox itself? And our second question is this, and you partially answered it. Talking to the American Academy of Neurology, we know that Botox is used very widely and in very young kids for cerebral palsy. But that raises a whole question, you know, they could be using it very early, and at what dose? Obviously, that's not something you regulate, but could you address that?
The first question had to do with how we know it's not bad Botox. I think we think that there's absolutely no evidence for that from any other report or any other angle. We think that we understand the mechanism of these serious adverse events, which we think is related to spread of the toxin from the local tissue where it's injected to more distant sites like the muscles of breathing. So we think we understand very well how these products work from a therapeutic point of view, and the mechanism for the adverse event. So my point being, these events are, we think anyway at the moment, understandable from the point of view of the pharmacology of the drug and how the drug works and how the body responds to it. So they're perfectly consistent with what we think the drug is capable of doing. And so we think we understand this. And there's no reason to believe that it's related to bad Botox, and I'm not even sure exactly what bad Botox means and what it would result in clinically if someone was injected with it. So we just think this is sort of consistent with what we know about the drug. So I think that's why we're not worried about that. The second question had to do with the dosing in young kids. I can't really speak to that. As they say, and as you reiterated, we don't know what the right dose is in these cases. We haven't approved the use of these products at any dose in this population. So it's hard for us to comment on what the right dose ought to be or what people are even doing out there.
Okay. Next question, please.
Jacob Goldstein with Wall Street Journal. You may ask your question.
Thanks. So does this early communication have any bearing at all on how physicians and patients should think about the cosmetic use of Botox?
We put the information out there for people to make their own personal best judgment about this. We have seen cases of something that looked like this with cosmetic use, very rare. I think people should be aware that there's a potential for this to happen. People presumably have different sensitivities to various doses, and so people should be on the lookout for it. And if somebody does use it cosmetically and they subsequently develop symptoms that might be related to this distant spread, then I think patients and physicians should take those symptoms seriously and think about this as a possibility.
And should this be, is the potential risk of these distant effects high enough that it should be considered as part of the risk-benefit analysis of somebody who's considering whether to get a cosmetic Botox treatment, or is it so low as to be is actually a non.
We're in the, as I've said before, we're in the process, the relatively early stages of looking at all the data in great detail. So it's hard to say. Right now, given the number of cases we have in hand, we think it's probably quite rare, given the number of reports we have and the apparently very large use for this indication. So right now, it's we think it's quite rare. But again, time will tell as we continue to review this. I think the main thing, again, from the cosmetic use, is that people should be aware that this is a possibility, however rare, and that if they do develop these symptoms, they should take note of them.
Thank you.
Great. Next question, please.
The next question comes from Anna Matthews with the Wall Street Journal. Okay, sorry there are so many of us. Just briefly, you said I think there were only one or two cases that may have been associated with cosmetic use, and none of them deaths. Were there any hospitalizations that were possibly associated with cosmetic use? I'm assuming not, but...
I have to check. Marketed product. I'm not sure there was... Yeah, actually, there was at least one hospitalization, but again, it was questionable as to whether that was related to the treatment or whether it was related to some other cause. But there was at least one hospitalization.
Someone getting Botox cosmetic.
Yeah, right.
At least one hospitalization.
Can you follow up, Anna?
Yeah.
We're going to just put you on hold, everybody on hold for 1 second, and one of our dermatology experts is going to give us some advice on this. Okay, we got a clarification.
Right. Let me clarify. They got a Botox for a cosmetic indication, but not Botox cosmetic.
Does that make sense?
Because those are two different, Botox and Botox cosmetic are different products.
Okay, so there was at least one hospitalization from someone who got Botox, not Botox cosmetic, but Botox, but got the Botox for a cosmetic use. Do you
right.
know what use then?
For glabellar, which is, you know, sort of these frown lines between the eyebrows, which it's approved.
Okay, and again, it was actually Botox, not Botox cosmetic.
Correct. That's the best information we have.
Okay, anything else you could tell us about that case, although forgive me, I understand it is just one case?
No, I don't want to really go into the details of the case, but it ended with weakness and hospitalization. Although, as I say, it's not entirely clear that it was treatment-related. It's possible it was.
Okay, next question, please.
Hi, Cusman with CNBC. Your line's open.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if this is the reason or one of the reasons why there's a delay in the approval of Raloxin, or if it isn't, if it could mean a further delay for that. And then separately, if you would please go down the list of symptoms and problems in layman's terms of what people should look for exactly. Thanks.
Yeah, I can't speak at all to what effect this, our consideration of this issue might have on some pending application. So I certainly can't speak to that at all. I think what we're mostly worried about is, and it's actually, I mean, the main ones are listed in the early communication, what's called difficulty swallowing, which is known as dysphagia, change in voice, a generalized weakness, and most particularly shortness of breath or difficulty breathing. There are other signs, but those are the ones that we list here, and those are the ones that droopy eyelids. And again, depending upon where the drug is injected, and again, we're talking here mostly today about distance effects in muscles that are quite distant from where the injection is. if you get injected in the legs and eyelids start to droop or your head becomes difficult to lift, anything that's a symptom attributable to muscular weakness distant from where the injection was, those are things that people should watch for.
Thank you.
Great. Are there any more questions?
And at this time, we have no further questions.
If there's anyone that would like to ask a question, please hit, is it star zero, star one?
Star one, ma'am, yes.
Okay, star one. Okay, if there's no further questions, then we'll end our call today. If you have any further questions, please call the FDA press office at 301-827-6242. Or you can email me. This is Sandy Walsh. It's sandy.walsh@fda.hhs.gov. Thank you.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may disconnect at this time.